Recording in Los Gatos, California on February 16th, 2016. This is GeekSpeak, episode 7 of our 16th season. You are listening to Independent Public Radio, 88.9 KOSP, Santa Cruz, and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geeks affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, your host and producer of GeekSpeak, and with me in the studio is Mr. Ben Jaffe. He's a software engineer, traveler, and music geek. Hey, Ben.
How's it going?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. You sound a little different.
You know, we're in a echoey room.
Yeah.
And so what I'm doing is... getting really close to the microphone. It's a more intimate style.
Yeah. Talking more quietly.
And since we're doing GeekSpeak and we do this via radio and podcasts and we have microphones in front of us all the time, I think we'll take the opportunity now to get an update on the microphone situation.
The microphone situation?
You are currently using a standard voice mic called an SM58.
Yeah, 58. Okay. That's the, for those of you who are not me sitting in front of this mic, it kind of looks like a snow cone.
Ice cream cone?
Ice cream, that's exactly it. Ice cream cone. I always insist on having the pink windscreen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a pink, bright bubblegum ice cream cone.
Those microphones are about $100. They're $99. You can get them online. And they're a very standard mic. They're really durable. You can hammer nails with them. I mean, they are durable microphones.
And they've been around since like the 80s
forever,
or something.
It's, forever.
That's the mic that you see on stage.
If you see a comedian holding a microphone, that's the microphone we're talking about.
That's the mic that Bon Jovi probably sings into.
I found out a while ago that you could get... No, I had to buy all the gear to have GeekSpeak portable.
Sure.
Because we record in Los Gatos. And so now I own all this stuff, which is kind of cool. But I didn't want to spend $400 on microphones because they're standard issue and they're not exciting. And so I went and found some $10 microphones. And the one I'm using is a $10 microphone.
But it looks the same.
It looks identical. In fact, it looks extremely identical. And in every way, it seems the same. I tried different sound comparisons by having both microphones using at the same time and switching back and forth between left channel. I could not hear any audio difference. But recently, I found what the actual difference is on the quality. Like, a very clear difference.
What's that?
All right. I want you to grab your microphone with your hand. Okay, Ben just grabbed his microphone with his hand.
Yeah.
We barely heard it. And the reason we barely heard it is it's got good isolation. I'm going to grab... We actually have stands, so we don't have to hold them. I'm going to grab my microphone with my hand.
Oh. Oh, no.
So again, this is my microphone.
This and is Ben's. My microphone.
It's just totally night and day.
I'm still...
Yeah, you could actually hold that microphone. It would be very hard for me to hold this microphone and be effective.
Should we try it for the rest of the show?
No.
We won't be able to type.
You know, Ben, Miles and I have sat and done the whole GeekSpeak holding microphones, but because I was using these microphones, I had to hold it really calmly. Anyway, that's enough of inside baseball for us, don't you think?
Yeah.
Let's talk about some software fails this week, Ben.
Because we're software engineers. We're going to start with a negative.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. These are always especially interesting to people like you and I who program for a living because it's so easy to make a mistake like this. And a lot of times these mistakes are just like, what? Like, why does that happen? So let me tell you this one. And be careful because you can really mess yourself up with this one. If you take a 64-bit iOS device, so that's like an iPhone 5S or an iPad Air or an iPad Mini 2 or newer.
Any of those things newer as well, of course, sure.
And you set its date to January 1st, 1970.
Unix
You're laughing,
time.
Of course.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's the first day of Unix time, basically. Yeah.
In fact, when we deal with time in Unix derivatives and OS X and iOS are Unix derivatives, the clock actually started on January 1st, 1970. That's the zero point. And
midnight,
we just
Midnight,
sorry. Yeah. And we just have a counter that goes milliseconds since then is basically our time.
Yeah. Now, before we talk more about that, I just want to say, if you're a listener and you're doing this right now, don't do it.
Don't do it.
Because what happens is if you set your date to January 1st, 1970 and you reboot, you have a bricked iPhone.
It just won't work.
It sits there and it shows you an Apple logo forever.
Oh, that's so sad.
And as far as I can tell, based on this article, you can't fix it.
You can't
wipe it because this is the time you're talking about. It's not your user data.
Right.
Right. And there may be some way to
open it up and do something to the motherboard or some sort, pull the memory or something. Gosh. That's bad.
It's really bad.
Don't
it's
do
really
it.
Bad. Yeah. But
so if you wanted to protect the data on your phone, you could do this.
Yeah, I guess this is the ultimate lock screen.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's not very useful.
Well, so that kind of is very similar to the talk we had last week about Apple. Do you hear about this one where Apple
What's
was?
That?
We already. You should listen to the show because we covered it pretty well. But basically, they had an update. If you would fix your phone with a thumb pad,
you fix
the thumb pad. If you then got it updated to iOS 9, the phone went dead. Because they couldn't trust the security patterns.
There were reports also of people replacing other things like the display, and it didn't work.
But
so.
Really, it's because of that. But anyway,
that's not good. That's
what's
not
the
good.
Next one for this week?
And why this happens?
Well,
no
the date
idea.
One?
Yeah,
oh, the date one. Yeah, I mean, why setting it back is a problem?
Okay,
most likely because they're using time in the early on, and it's a negative value or a zero value.
But
and
why
so
would they do that if it's 64-bit? Like, you've got so many numbers if you're 64-bit. The reason that you would go from 32-bit to 64-bit in terms of like thinking about time is that basically you run out of numbers. And so if you have a certain amount of space in your device to store the time, and the time, the number of milliseconds since 1970, January 1st, 1970 at midnight, when that number gets big enough that it's too big for the storage you've allocated for it, then it'll roll back around to zero again.
Yeah.
And then your device will think that it's... And that's going to happen in like 2032 or something like that.
Yeah, that definitely has... Yeah, I understand the concern is that milliseconds you're talking about has a... when milliseconds are at a certain point and it gets above a 32-bit number, you've got a problem. Yeah, I think that is in the 32 somewhere in there. But that's...
It's the Y2K...
That's actually not a problem in the sense that you could just re-engineer so your number represented two digits was your number, right? 2 bytes were your number.
Sure.
And that would be effectively the same. It's not like you have a big lookup problem there.
Yeah, so I guess like looking at it, I can see why it might be related, but I can't...
I don't think it's related. I think the reason why you have a relation is that they were redoing the infrastructure of how the system booted up and everything. And there's some bug in it that causes this to occur. I don't think it has to do with the actual, that the words are longer and therefore there's a problem. I think it's much more about implementation.
Okay, yeah.
And I don't know if they'll fix it. They probably will fix it, but for now, just avoid
I would
it.
Hope they would fix it.
Yeah. Interesting.
I wonder
does that if mean if I got an old iPhone, I can change the date back and it's okay?
You can go ahead and try that if you want.
Why would you want to change your date?
I don't know. Okay. I mean, I'm also interested if you changed it to January 1st, 1970 at like 3:45 p.m., I wonder if that would break your device.
Here's my iPhone 6. You try that.
You want me to try?
No, let's go on.
Okay, so we're going to move on from Apple to Adobe.
I really like Adobe products, I have to say. I realized this recently that I, over the years, have done a lot of work in Lightroom, which is the photo manager.
Yeah.
And I've got over 200,000 photographs in my Lightroom collection.
200,000?
Over 200,000 photos,
God,
yeah.
You're insane.
And 20,000 are you. No,
do you really take that many photos?
I used to take a lot more than I do when I had younger kids, but I do take quite a bit. But keep in mind that all the photos that are on my phone or my multiple phones or my Google Glass or my iPads or my kids' phones or my wife's phone, they all end up in this library because that way I know I have a good backup.
Yeah.
So little videos my kids do, all that, that's all gets consumed in this one system. And having a centralized system is really nice because I know that if I've essentially... I've got all the photos in there, and then I run my backup strategy. I've got a cloud, a copy. I've got a local, NAS copy. I've got a copy that goes with me. You know, I can't lose these photos. Well, knock on wood. But anyway, so I like Lightroom from that perspective.
Yeah. And I want to say that Adobe gets a lot of hate from a lot of people.
Really?
Yeah, definitely. But at the same time, their software has kind of stood the test of time. Yep. Photoshop's been around for ages, and people will complain about it being bloated or whatever.
Yeah.
But like, there aren't many other pieces of software that last that long that can't have huge breaking changes all the time. You know, it's amazing.
Constantly, I find myself when I'm doing some editing that Photoshop could do the work, but maybe wouldn't be the best solution.
Right.
I'll do it in something else for a while, and then I'll finally step over to Photoshop and just handle it because I know Photoshop so well. The other thing is I use Adobe Audition.
Adobe Audition, yeah.
To edit all the Geek Speak shows. So now I'm using Adobe from a sound perspective too, and it's pretty good.
So if you're hearing our voices, it's
Adobe
made
was involved.
Its way through
but they're not paying Audition. For us, it's commercial. It's pretty
anyway,
bad.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
So what'd they do this week?
Adobe Creative Cloud users started having this problem after they updated Adobe Creative Cloud, where the first folder in the root drive on your Mac, it would just delete it.
Oh, no. No. I want to see what that folder is on the machine.
If you're
when you say first, you mean alphabetically?
Yeah, alphabetically, including hidden folders. So one of the...
mine's applications. That wouldn't kill me.
Is there a dot something, though?
I think I'm doing it.
Okay. Well, anyway.
Is it directory only?
I don't know. I think it's... The article says it's directory only, but it could be a file.
Yeah, my first one on the dot perspective is document revisions-v100.
Right.
That sounds bad.
I'll just throw it away.
Let me do that.
And actually, one of the ways that they caught this is a particular company called Backblaze, which is does backup stuff. They store a bunch of stuff in dot, what is it? Dot Backblaze something, something, something.
Definitely the first directory.
Yeah. A lot of people. And just...
So updating, so CS or Creative Solutions or Creative Cloud. Basically, it's a service that you subscribe to and you get to download and use the software from Adobe, and you pay a monthly fee rather than a big package fee. And when you stop paying, it goes away. So it's kind of devious, but also kind of awesome in the sense it's easy to get initiated and started. It's not like a $700 purchase to Photoshop or something like that. But it is a little weird.
I love that the company Backblaze, after figuring this out, they offered some guidance. They said, go ahead and create a folder. If you don't want to have your data deleted, create a folder called .adobe don't delete my BZ volume.
That's awesome.
Which is pretty good.
But in general, when you actually ran the software, it auto-updates for you.
Yeah,
so one day, all of a sudden, your machine just got erased, or one drive got erased. They have fixed this by the way.
Yes, they have. And why?
A bug.
I don't know.
You know, that's a tough one.
It could be anything. It seems so random and arbitrary. It sounds like Creative Cloud just woke up one day and decided to go insane and do something totally random.
It's so funny because it's one of those things that you really got to be careful about. Deleting directories, don't do
that.
That's really bad.
Yeah.
Imagine Netflix. You look at me, you boot Netflix, just deletes the directory. I'm like, I'd be losing my job quick.
Now, while we're on this topic of bad software bugs...
Yes.
There's actually someone made a script called Get Blame Someone Else. So
I know what this means right away, but now you have some explaining to do.
Right, exactly. What this means right away is we have to explain what Git is, just really briefly. So Git is what we call a version control system. So if I'm working on a piece of software, one way that I keep track of what I did now versus 20 minutes ago versus 40 minutes ago versus before I started working on this particular feature is I use this software called Git, and that tracks
GIT,
and it tracks not just the files that I'm working on. You can almost imagine like taking the directory that has all of your work in it and making a duplication, just all the time, whenever you're working, whenever you do something, it makes a duplicate. Now, of course, it doesn't actually make a duplicate. It just tracks the changes. And there's a whole bunch of depth that we could go into that we're not going to go into right now.
But another good way of explaining this is if you've ever worked on a Word document with somebody, mm-hmm. and you write something and then you send it to them and they write something and they send it back and you go back and forth and back and forth through email. This is a common thing. It becomes really tricky to find out what's going on. Track changes, if you turn that on, kind of highlights what changes are, and you can click on them and see who wrote what. That is versioning control.
Right. And Git is basically like that for everything that's not MS Word documents or Google Drive. Now, if you and I want to work on something, let's say the GeekSpeak website, we might use Git to keep track of our changes, and we could both work offline separate from each other. And then when we come back together, Git will
help
most of the time. Yeah, it'll help us, it'll facilitate the interaction of like, you did this, Lyle did this, let's merge those together.
And merge is actually the command you use to merge those things together.
Yes, mm-hmm. indeed.
Now, so there's a lot more detail about that, but let's go on.
Let's say there's a bug in the GeekSpeak website. Okay. And I'm like, who wrote this horrible line of code?
Well, let's see. You've done one commit, and Brian's done one commit, so I wrote the code.
You wrote the code, right. Well, let's just imagine that I was a little more involved. I would run Git blame on the file.
Git blame.
Blame. Mm-hmm. Git space blame. And that would tell me Lyle Troxell, Lyle, whatever.
It actually goes in every line, tells you who wrote it. And when they wrote it.
Yeah, so just yeah. Lyle Troxell, Lyle Troxell, Lyle Troxell. But yeah, and you also have, you can look at when they wrote it. You can also look at all the other things they changed at that point.
Right.
So you can get the context for their change.
Sure.
So Git blame is fantastic. Git Blame Someone Else is a script that someone wrote, which will change the author of a commit. A commit is basically a change, right? So, I write some code, and then we'll just charitably say it's not my best work. So I could just run
like the GeekSpeak website.
I could just run Git Blame Someone Else, Lyle Troxel in your email, and this script will change the quote unquote author of this commit to whoever I want it to. Now, of course, this isn't actually something that will, like, this is detectable, right?
Right.
Mainly just this person wrote it because it's funny.
It sounds really funny.
Totally. But anyway, if you commit some code like that.
I got to say, as a full-time developer using Git all the time with lots of people, it is an example of a computer doing something right.
Right.
When it works, it just feels so good. And it never really doesn't work. I mean, but in general, besides the interface being a little hard and a little designed for the programmer rather than the individual, it has so much features and strength that you feel empowered using the computer. And those kind of tools, whenever you find a tool that makes you feel like you're a better computer user, you know that's good software.
Yes, definitely. Also, I just want to clear up a misconception. When I first started using Git, it felt like Git Blame is kind of a negative thing, you know.
There's a synonym for it.
Who can I blame for this? And the reality is that when you use Git Blame to figure out who did something, it's not so much to blame them, it's more to ask them, hey, why did you do this, or what's the context of your change? Or
yeah, and the blame is just coming from the author. He's a jerk. There's a synonym for the Git Blame command, I'm pretty sure.
I don't know.
Linus Torvalds, the person that invented Linux operating system, also wrote Git. Which is kind of amazing, because normally somebody that does something so monumental normally has one thing in their life they do.
Yeah, right, exactly.
But this is two, and I would say that, I don't know. The thing is, there's alternatives to Git, just like there are alternatives to the operating system, so they're not that amazing.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Anyway.
Anyway, should we move on?
Sure, why not? We could talk about more programming fails. Actually,
yeah, let's do that.
Let's not. Let's talk about something that maybe seems like a programming fail, but really it's just a bad choice. And this is about Samsung. And I think a while back we talked about Samsung and their smart TVs and how their smart TVs are listening.
Yes.
Yeah, so the idea is do OK Google Navigate Home. What it actually does is it's listening. My phone is listening, and it hears OK Google, right? It hears that keyword, and when it hears that keyword, it starts listening, and then it starts sending the audio to Google's servers. So I say OK Google, and then it starts sending the audio to Google servers. Google servers interpret whatever I say and send the data back, right?
Meaning that Google's not getting everything it hears all the time.
Oh,
it's
no.
Only after that keyword that the data goes to Google.
Right now, my phone is not sending this conversation between you and I back to Google, right? And the reason...
As far as you know.
Well, I did just say, okay, Google. So maybe it is. But anyway, it's kind of tricky, you know? Like, it's a difficult software problem, I guess, to solve, where you want your phone, which doesn't have a great CPU or anything like that, you want it to be able to listen for, basically do voice recognition on its dinky little processor without all of Google's servers to help, right? And this goes for Siri as well. I don't know, what do you say with Siri? Okay, Siri?
No, you just say Siri.
Oh, you just say Siri, right.
But not everybody has that on by default.
So Samsung smart TVs do this as well, right? But the difference is that rather than their TVs doing the keyword, the hotkey listening, they're sending everything back to Samsung, which means that if this, I mean, there's a TV in this room right now. If this were a smart TV, a Samsung smart TV, it ostensibly would be sending all of the data, all of our conversation back to Samsung for processing.
That seems so expensive.
It seems really expensive.
Meaning that, from the perspective of like streaming everyone that has one of these TVs data back to Samsung, Samsung has to receive all that data.
Yeah. No, it's not just a constant audio stream. It's probably whenever there's enough sound.
Yeah, sure.
Whenever the amplitude of the
near. Well, that's kind of a fail, but also that means that they could potentially just start listening anytime without any changes to the back end.
Or someone could compromise their systems.
That's true.
You know, listen. So that's not good. And actually, the reason that we're covering it again is that Samsung actually issued a new statement clarifying how the voice activation works, and they say, quote, if a consumer consents and uses the voice recognition feature, voice data is provided to a third party during a requested voice command search.
Thanks, Samsung.
And then they say, at that time, the voice data is sent to the to a server, which searches the requested content, then returns the desired content to the TV. So, and they did update their policy a little bit after releasing that to clarify who the third party is. Right. Like, but yeah, it's lazy, you know.
Yeah, like, I feel like it's lazy too.
Okay, instead of putting the functionality that we need to not potentially compromise our customers' privacy, instead of putting that on the phone, that would be some engineering work, or maybe right. It would require more engineering resources than we have at this moment, or whatever. They decided to go with the cheap alternative, at least in terms of the developer short-term resources,
right, and the hardware being installed.
So this does not bode well for my trust in Samsung.
And you know, personally, if you don't use the searching, the voice activated services on your TV, just go turn them off. Yeah. Same with Xbox too. And as well with your phone. If you don't end up using Google Voice very much, just go turn off the service from listening until you push a button.
And actually, Google Voice is not listening to me right now. Google is not listening to me right now because my phone is off. And I have it set so when my phone screen is turned off, it doesn't even do the recognition
That's
on
a great
my
idea.
Device.
I wish iOS had this kind of option.
It just means I have to unlock my phone every time I want to do something.
You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. With me is Ben Jaffe. We'll be right back. We're going to talk about gravity waves and how we recently...
Gravitational waves.
Thank you. Gravitational waves.
I keep making
waves.
That mistake.
Stick with us. This is Geek Speak on KOSP. You can join us online on Twitter or Facebook. We're KOSP Geeks, and we'd love to hear from you. You got questions, corrections, reach out to us online, KOSP Geeks, or geeks at geekspeak.org if you want to email us. All right. Ben, what's the difference between gravity waves and gravitational waves?
Gravity waves don't exist. Is that right? Gravity waves.
Well, let's talk about gravitational waves then, shall we?
Right. No, it looks like when you search for gravity waves, it shows you all of the gravitational wave results. So I think it's just specifically called gravitational waves, and that's the name for it. But I keep trying to make that mistake. I keep like having to catch myself and correct myself. Gravitational waves are awesome. So the idea is that when there are... See, I don't want to do a bad job explaining this, and I'm not a physicist. I also could just take this opportunity to plug my other podcast where I do it with a physicist, and we talk about gravitational waves, and she does a much better job. But basically, you've got this space-time continuum thing, right? This is where we all live. This is where we what we exist in, what everything exists in. And the idea is that gravity is not just this force that pulls on you or pulls on celestial bodies or everything. It's actually something that can propagate as waves, right? Which is kind of a fundamentally amazing idea, mm-hmm. right? That this space-time continuum that we exist in can actually have waves, much like a pool can have water waves. Or our atmosphere can have waves. Like right now, let's imagine I wasn't wearing headphones. I'd be listening to you. You'd be listening to me talk through air. Mm-hmm. And the way that you're perceiving me is by listening to the vibrations in the substrate between us, in right. the air between us.
When you speak, a little bit of pressure wave comes up at part of your voice, and then the trailing part of the voice, a lull in the pressure happens, and that repeatedly comes across and hits little bones in my ear, which vibrate the bones and then then trigger nerves to hear. Like, that's kind of how it works.
Yeah, trigger nerves so to send signals, and your brain interprets it.
It's all about the compression
and what's the word for that?
We should
anti-compression.
We should have some thesaurus looking before we started this conversation.
Just like,
so the yeah. air compressing and expanding.
Yes, that's the word. Thank you.
Cause it, that little bit of vibration or that little bit of movement is actually really fast, relatively fast.
Yeah,
and that's the actual sound we're hearing. And of course, you know that when you hear deeper voices or you hear higher voices, what's actually happening is those waves and the crests of the waves are closer, farther apart, right. or closer together.
So the frequency, if the frequency is lower, then we're talking about the further apart, right? And right. if the frequency is higher, then we're talking about these pressure waves going through the air, being closer together.
And an example of this actually is that it's more challenging to move a lot of air. You have to have a large surface area, and that's why deep speakers, bass speakers, are big in diameter.
Generally
and
speaking,
high frequencies are tweeters are small.
Oh yeah. Oh, I thought you were talking about people too. No. Generally, people who have larger. Larger systems mm-hmm. through which they make sound, right?
Right.
Larger heads and all that stuff. They tend to make lower sounds, and people who have smaller heads tend to make,
If you know any
flutist,
a saxophone player, a trumpeter, anybody that uses their air to produce sound with a musical instrument, you'll know that they can hold a higher pitch frequency, a higher frequency sound for longer than a lower. Unless, of course, they're somebody that does...
I think that's wrong.
No. Well, I mean, I know from a saxophone perspective, if you try to do a really deep bass D on a saxophone, like a tenor sax, and you try to hold that for a long time, it's harder than doing a high note because you have to push a lot more air and your lungs just can't hold as much.
I think that's a little different. Being a clarinetist, I think it's a little, there are more confounding
factors.
Well,
the clarinetist isn't a lot of difference in the amount of volume of air, right? Because
it's complicated, right?
Yeah.
So with wind instruments, it's complicated. But another example is the strings of a piano or mm-hmm. of a guitar. If you pluck the lowest string on a guitar, you can actually see it kind of vibrating back and forth really, really fast. If you pluck the highest string, you may not even be able to see it.
It's
going faster.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is the reason why we're talking about waves and kind of getting a feel for it and understanding it is that the story of finding gravitational waves has to do with using other waves as well. And that's kind of a neat, we have to shift to that at some point. But basically, what we're talking about is recently a machine that was designed to detect gravitational waves detected the first time gravitational waves directly.
Now, we have detected them indirectly before, but this is the first instance of us actually detecting them directly. And the way we did so is really interesting. So maybe we'll just describe the detector really fast.
Can we just talk for a second about, like, we are always feeling the gravity of the Earth, uh-huh. right? Because it's got a mass, we're always being accelerated down. Our feet feel the pressure of the Earth against it, holding back that acceleration. And there's some complicated concepts in there, but that's how you should think about it in some sense. It's the best way for us to explain it, mm-hmm. is that you're accelerating towards the mass of the Earth. The Earth is accelerating towards the mass of the Sun, but because it's in a directional orbital, because it's moving linearly from the direction, yeah. it kind of falls forever in a circle. But not
right,
all,
yeah,
forever.
In orbit, right.
Yeah, but the point is that we're not talking about something from a long distance away causing a tug at us that we felt. The wave effect is much more elusive than that. It's very light effect, but it also happens only when a large mass accelerates or changes, moves around. And so that's what would have to happen for a large gravity wave. And the effect is a distortion in space. And that's a really important thing to understand about gravity. What the Earth actually does as a gravity well is causes a distortion in space. And so
in
space-time. And the time and the space are the same effect. They're actually coupled together. So let's go on about how we actually found it. Well, what did we surmise happened in September? In September,
I want to describe the detector first,
okay.
because the detector has been around for a very long time. And it's a really, really neat idea. It's called LIGO. Of course, being an acronym, I always read it as being shouted. So whenever it's in a sentence,
I don't do that. It's great.
No, anyway, LIGO, LIGO. So LIGO is actually two facilities, and they're separated by 1,900 miles. The reason that we do this is that if there are some localized disturbances that cause us to think we detected something and we only see them in one place, we can know pretty much for certain that that was a local disturbance and it was not actually a gravitational wave, right? So that's the two facilities and the redundancy.
This is common for astronomy, actually. You really want a double location check because it's
validation.
Such, yeah. And the thing is with this detector, because it's kind of the way it works, we'll see here in a second, if a truck drove by in the wrong way, you could see that as a detection.
Yeah.
But of course, only one of them would see that detection, not the other. And so you can cancel those anomalies out.
Right.
By the way, the LIGO, what does it stand again?
LIGO.
LIGO. Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory.
And we'll get into those words in a second.
But it looks like a giant L.
Yeah, it looks like a giant L. So So here's kind of the picture that we could paint in your mind. Let's say that you've got a really, really, really long building. Okay, that's one side of the L. And then you've got another really, really, really long building. They're the same length, and they form a right angle. They look like an L. And basically, the idea is that you shoot a laser into this special kind of mirror, and the mirror will divide the laser out and shoot the laser down both from the crook of the L, shoot the laser down both the up and down building and the side to side building. So this laser gets split up, goes traveling down both of these arms, bounces back off of a mirror, and then gets recombined. Now the idea, what we're trying to detect, is if one of these arms actually expands or contracts, gets, and I'm putting this in air quotes, longer or shorter than the other one, then we can infer that maybe there was a gravitational wave that passed through,
mm-hmm.
because it distorted space-time and actually created more space. This is fuzzy, for the laser to travel through along
more
one
distance
axis.
For laser travel.
Yeah, more distance for laser to travel along one axis in relation to the other. So this is a really neat idea of like, how can we detect this? The reason that we want to use specifically a laser is that what we're trying to do is we're trying to detect very, very small differences. It's not like you could just put a really long like light ruler. You couldn't just bounce a pulse down both of these arms and then measure whether they come back at the same time. We're talking about incredibly, incredibly small variances, like variances in length that are similar to what was the number? It was like the width of a proton.
No, it's much less than the width of a proton and the full length of the arm. By the way, the length of these buildings are 4 kilometers per length. So it's a 4 kilometer building and a 4 kilometer building. What is that? Almost 2 miles.
Uh-huh.
And there's a reflector at the end of each of them. That's amazing, right there. And right. What they're able to do is the two lasers come back, the interferometer.
Before we get into that.
What is it called again?
Interferometer.
Interferometer. They interfere with each other, and that interference is the difference we're talking about. So it's talking about a really, really minuscule amount of difference.
Right. So just to take a step back, right? We're trying to measure incredibly small differences between these arms, okay?
0.0001 times the size of an atom nucleus.
Or also a thousandth the diameter of a proton. That was the number I was thinking of.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I just didn't want to get the order of magnitude wrong.
Sure.
So, how can we do this? Well, in order to describe how we can do something like that, we actually need to talk a little bit about what interference patterns
are. Yes,
because otherwise we're just going to throw jargon out and it won't make any sense. So interference patterns are, if you have these two waves, okay, if you're a mathematician, you can imagine you have a sine wave and an inverse sine wave, okay, and you add those together, you're going to get nothing. If you have a sound wave and the exact inverse of that sound wave, and you merge them together, you're going to get nothing. If you have a light wave and you have the inverse of the light wave, you merge them together and you're going to get nothing, because the peaks and the troughs of all of those waves will cancel each other out exactly. And that, incidentally, that's exactly the way the noise isolating headphones that I'm wearing on my head right now work when they're turned on.
So what they do is they have a microphone on the outside. They hear the sound on the outside of the room. They pull that, they record the sound in, and then they inverse the sound, reverse the phase of it, making the highs low and the lows high. And then they play it back to you at a very low level that matches the outside air, and therefore you hear nothing.
Right, exactly. Oddly. They take the sound you're about to hear, they very quickly generate the opposite of it,
yes,
and then they play it back. And when those two waves go together, or merge together, you end up hearing nothing.
The best way to physically understand this is to sit into a long bathtub, and sit in a bathtub, and I'm hoping that people have done this before. You get the bath filled up, and if you push your belly forward or kind of push your torso forward,
you'll make a wave.
Yeah, you'll make a wave of water kind of push across, and it will bounce against the backside and will come back to you. If you do it again when it's traveling the same way, like comes behind you and then goes forward again, and you do it again, it'll get bigger and bigger. You can get it so that all the water gets slushes out of the tub. It's a mess.
Yeah.
The other thing you can do is you can start it, you know, do it 3 or 4 times, you get this wave going, and then when it comes back at you, as it's coming towards you, you push against it. And what you're doing is you're actually you're canceling
merging,
out.
You're yeah. merging the wave that's coming back to you with the wave that you just made.
Right.
And you end up with these peaks and these troughs
that match.
And the yeah, exactly.
So you can basically stop the water from moving if you time it right. And that's all we're really talking about. It just happens we're talking about scales that are unhuman.
Yeah, that's called a standing wave, by the way.
When the wave bounces back and forth?
Yeah, where you end up with this wave that kind of goes back and forth, but doesn't appear to move on the surface. So
that's what is this called wave interference, when you have two waves that interfere with each other. Yeah. And they can do lots of different things. They can cancel each other. They can add to each other. They can make really complex things. That's basically all about music, but we won't get into that.
So
these big, long laser tubes, they're 4 kilometers long. How do they do this?
Didn't understand the question.
Well,
they're 4 kilometers long.
So they're 4 kilometers long, and they split the laser. So the laser is the exact same type, and then it bounces off the end and cancels itself, potentially.
Yes, exactly. So the big question is, I guess the big question to tie all this together is, what does interference pattern, what do interference patterns have to do with what we were just talking about? So if you got these two lasers that are going out, they're exactly the same, and they come back and they merge back together. If you have one of them that's inverted, then you're going to get no signal at all. And if one of the arms gets a little bit longer or a little bit shorter, then that wave, basically the wave that comes back, is going to be shifted a little bit forward or backward. And now all of a sudden, these two waves won't perfectly cancel out anymore.
And you'll get laser light coming through.
Right. Now, this is assuming that all of your equipment is perfect and perfectly aligned. There's no source of interference. And that's a really big if.
So what you're saying, when they really set this up and there's no detection,
right,
they get no laser light coming out of it. And that's the idea, is those two distances are perfectly the same. They've made it perfect, like to a wavelength, perfectly the same distance. And therefore, what you see is that perfect cancelization, the sensors, which are really detect really well, see nothing.
Exactly.
Then if you went over to it and you kind of tapped on the mirror, there'd be this giant spike in light that would come out, because all of a sudden the laser distance would be really drastic.
If you tapped on the mirror, you would probably get shot at by some physicist who spent all of it like polishing this thing. These mirrors are incredibly
sure.
Yeah, it's amazing, actually. There's a whole long article that we have up on geekspeak.org that I highly recommend anyone who's even at all interested in this read through this thing, because it tells, it gives a lot of details. It also does a great job of explaining some of the pieces of it. And it also talks about the specifics of how it was detected and under what circumstances, which we'll get into in a second. But yeah, if everything was perfectly aligned, you would see no signal. And then if you just said something in a control room that was relatively close, just the vibration of your voice might change things. If a truck drives by or a car drives by relatively near, that's going to change things. It's incredible how well calibrated these things have to be in order to eliminate all of this noise. And you also have all kinds of things, like you have the entire thing is built on basically these very good shock absorbers, these rubber pads, so that way the entire building doesn't tend to vibrate very much. You've got the mirror that splits the laser suspended from an extremely delicate and fine thread, so that way you can remove a lot of sources of potential motion for the mirror. Because if the mirror moves even a fraction of what you're trying to detect, it's going to move the laser beam quite a bit off track. So it's incredibly hard.
I love that. Like, I think of making something not move, you want to attach more stuff to it. But that's right. Exactly what you don't want to do in this situation. You want to just take the mirror and have a lot of mass in it and attach it very lightly. So effectively, it slowly, stops from moving, if you will, because its mass, there's nothing acting upon it to cause it to move, rather than trying to attach it to the ground, which is shifting, and there's vibrations in the air, and the heating duct causes it a little bit of noise and all that.
Yeah.
Taylor and Hughes won the Nobel Prize for discovering, basically, the first time a measurement showed the effect of energy being wasted in gravitational waves. And so we can talk a little bit about the first attempt of this, of detecting gravitational waves. And it wasn't really they detected gravity waves, but the two neutron stars that were circling each other, as they get really close together, they're accelerated by each other because they're orbiting
getting
really,
faster,
really fast.
faster, yeah.
Right. And as they accelerate like that, the act of accelerating a mass in the gravity field causes these ripples. That's basically effectively.
So there's energy going out and being dispersed as gravity waves.
Right. That's actually what it is. In fact, the study of the two black holes that orbit each other and basically consumed each other, the amount of energy that was used up, if you will, by producing these gravitational waves, the single event released as much gravity as the sun would, our sun will release in 15 trillion years. So we're talking about immense amount of energy. That's why we can detect it from so far away.
Yeah. And just to bring this to the particular announcement, which was fairly recent, they detected in September, they detected an event, which then they spent several months
like confirming all
did
that.
We really did right. we really are we sure what they detected was actually two massive black holes that were spiraling towards each other and then at one point just went together, and that was what we detected,
right?
Was all of that energy being released. It's incredible, the amount of energy.
And the basic idea is that as they get closer and closer to each other, they orbit each other very, very fast, and the amount of energy used in the gravitational waves creation actually reduces their orbital distance, and they consume really quickly. So the last moments happen really quickly.
Yeah. It's kind of like if you're... This is this isn't a great example, I guess, of what happened, but you can kind of almost imagine it. If you imagine a figure skater who is spinning around with their arms out and they're holding these balls, and then these weighty balls, if they pull in their arms, they're going to get going really, 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 really fast. And that's basically what's happening, except with two black holes and no figure skater and gravity. And as they go faster and faster and faster, the frequency of the gravitational wave gets higher and higher.
Changes.
And we'll get back to that in just a sec.
That's right. You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle, and I'm talking with Ben, and we will be right back. You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm with Ben Jaffe. We're talking about detecting gravitational waves at the LIGO facility. Recently, a major event happened. Okay, so.
How long ago?
Well, I should say that recently we detected the gravitational waves, and since it's part of our universe, I'm assuming they travel the speed of light, right?
So these black holes that we just detected, kind of a once in a lifetime event for the black holes, at least, 1.3 billion years ago.
Wow, that's a long time ago.
It's like before dinos.
Before
the dinos. So since well before the dinosaurs, these waves have been traveling to us.
You know, here's a great another piece of this about how much energy it is. Because, of course, that affects the wake, the gravitational waves that were emanated from this destruction of these two black holes, or merging these two black holes, emanated throughout the galaxy that far, right, or through the universe, excuse me, that far. And it's how many billions
of
years?
So 1.3 billion years.
So that the red horizon, if you will, of that event, everywhere from that distance, the beings could see that, right? The amount of energy... The black holes had a masses of 36 souls, if you will. That was one mass. And 36 times the soul and 29 times soul. So those two
soul being
masses.
The mass of our sun.
That's right. So they're big black holes. I mean, not big, giant black holes, but they're black holes. They're big. They merged together and they created one single black hole, a mass of 62 times the sun. So you may, if you had your math correctly, you might go, wait, what happened to the three souls of energy?
Thank you. I wasn't doing the math.
Okay. Effectively, the energy that was used in creating the gravitational waves is effective of three times our sun's mass.
That's incredible. The sun is big.
Yeah, it's big. Anyway, that's pretty cool.
Wow.
So you had this really interesting story about them actually how they're turning on, they're testing it. They reworked the machine in September. What's the story of them actually discovering them?
Right. So apparently, LIGO is not a new observatory. It's been around for a while, right?
Decades.
Yeah. Specifically, they changed LIGO to be more advanced and more
sensitive.
Thank you. That's the
word. They polished them mirrors. Probably put in stronger lasers and the whole deal.
Oh my gosh. So much of this process was trying to remove different kinds of interference. Mm-hmm. And so, this article talks about this guy, last name Weiss. He was pulled in from Boston a week prior to the start date to
Which
try
was,
to track
what was the
down,
start date?
September 18th.
Okay.
To try to track down the source of some of the radio frequency interference. And he says I get there and I was horrified. He said it was everywhere. And so he recommended, let's just take the whole thing offline. It'll be about a week. But the project's directors decided, no, we're not going to delay the first observing run any longer. And he basically said, thank God they didn't let me do it, because I would have had the whole thing offline when the signal came in.
Oh, the black holes came in during that week.
Yes.
Like, if they would turn it off, they wouldn't have seen him. Oh, that would have been so
they
bad.
They didn't take his advice, and he's like, thank God, thank God. And then also, on Sunday, September 13th, they spent the day at the Livingston site, one of the two sites, finishing a bunch of last-minute tests. So it says, quote, we yelled, we vibrated things with shakers, we tapped on things, we introduced magnetic radiation, we did all kinds of things, she said. And of course, everything was taking longer than it was supposed to. At 4 a.m, with one test left to do, a simulation of a truck driver hitting his brakes nearby, they decided to pack it in, the article says. They drove home, leaving the instrument to gather data in peace, and the signal arrived at 4:50 a.m.
No way.
50 minutes after they went home. So if they had done that last test, they may have also missed it, at least at one of their sites. Yeah, yeah. And then they wouldn't be able to validate, right?
And of course, we're talking about this in February, and this happened in September, and that's because of science, right? You've got to then really make sure your data's good. And that's what they've been doing, is writing the papers and studying and all that. And they've released a really great paper covering exactly what happened. You brought up a really a wonderful perspective of this that I hadn't really thought of. And that is that this is different.
This is different. This isn't just some cool, awesome discovery.
Which it is.
This is kind of world changing in a way.
Say, with gravitas is what you'd say.
Yes. Yeah. Don't underestimate the gravity of the situation.
We have tons of telescopes that are looking out there, right? We have radio telescopes. You're always talking about the one that finds exoplanets.
Kepler,
which is in orbit, and it's a radio.
It's looking at the light differences in stars.
Right.
So, yeah.
And we have a whole bunch of radio type telescopes, and we have visual telescopes.
We have infrared.
Right. Hubble's a great example of that. Tons of them.
What do all of those telescopes have in common?
They all are telescopes, which means they see light and light energy.
Yeah, they detect electromagnetic radiation. That's a hard
one to
say. That's
right, electromagnetic radiation.
Because infrared, heat, light, radio waves, gamma radiation.
All that's part of the same spectrum.
It's all the same stuff.
X-rays.
Fundamentally, X-rays. Now, we can't see all of those things. We can only see the visible light spectrum, but it's all fundamentally the same stuff, right? In fact, if you're listening to us on the radio, the thing that's carrying our voices to you is radio. It's effectively really, really low frequency light.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't detect electromagnetic radiation.
That's right.
This detects gravitational waves. So
a completely different way of looking at the universe. Not even looking at the universe.
Hearing.
You're hearing. So wait, why do you use the analogy of hearing? Because we talked about this earlier. So the light analogy is perfect. Radio waves and light, it's part of the same spectrum. Our eyeballs are actually really narrow band radio receivers.
Yeah, they're very bad telescopes.
Well, they're okay telescopes, but yeah, they do no infrared. They do no ultraviolet, because by definition, those things mean they're outside
of the human sight.
They
certainly don't do radio waves.
And, well, that's the thing, is that it's in that spectrum. So it's a very minimal part of the spectrum view
of
the world.
It's true.
And we have all these great tools that do more of that.
I do have to say, they have horrible resolution.
Yeah, they really do.
They're horrible telescopes.
But you suggest that the gravitational sensing tool, is more like hearing. Why?
Yes, it's because in a way, our environment, you and I, Lyle, in this room, is the air around us. Mm-hmm. We exist in this room that's filled with air, and we can't see the air, but the fact that we can hear each other is because of the air. If you were to suck all of the air out of the room, aside from the fact that we'd be dead in a couple seconds,
it would take a couple minutes.
If I tried to talk to you, you wouldn't be able to hear me, because the thing through which our voices are transmitted is the air. That's the substrate. That's the carrier, in a sense. Gravitational waves travel through this via the space-time continuum. So it is very different in certain ways.
I think all the geeks out there's heckles will raise, because there's no ether.
There's no ether.
Medium, if
this
you
is
will.
Not the subluminous ether from the 1800s.
No,
this
no.
is not the there is something that permeates everything. But
this is the space-time continuum, that has gravity wells, if you will.
But the point is, it's a vibration of that. It's a vibration of the space-time continuum, as opposed to something traveling through it, right?
Which, like radio waves, if you will.
Like radio waves, exactly, right. So it's fundamentally different. It's a fundamentally different paradigm of looking at the universe. It's a fundamentally different force.
What about so another telescope I was thinking of is down in Antarctica. We have under ice sheets sensors that are detecting neutrinos. And this is called, I think, Deep Blue is one of the names of these. And those things is a neutrino has to go in there and coincidentally hit something that causes a luminescent effect so we can see it. But the actual detection is something colliding. So that would be more like what, touch or smell?
It's kind of like smell.
I didn't know
that there was a South Pole neutrino observatory.
Oh,
I knew that they existed. I only knew that because
a friend of mine, if somebody I met at a party, was like, "What do you do?"
I hope it wasn't me.
I go down to Antarctica and I work on a giant under ice telescope.
That sounds for neutrino detection. That sounds awful. I hate the cold.
Really?
Yeah, I do.
You'd go there in a heartbeat.
But that's I don't know. Maybe if the flight was paid for. But yeah, that kind of is like smell, because you've got this. Apologies if I get the details wrong, but I think you just have this basically a huge vat of chlorine, a huge pool of chlorine.
Frozen water. It's just water.
It's just water?
Yeah, it's water.
What does a neutrino do to the water?
There's actually sensors inside. Neutrino can hit water molecules.
But the way that we detect
it's very rare.
Is that the neutrino hits something and changes that something.
The water molecule breaks apart and a little bit of light is produced, I believe. It's
really?
This is a very low level.
I think they have huge vats of chlorine and other detectors,
definitely.
And then the neutrino hits it and it knocks something and you end up with something else.
But putting that aside, we have all these light telescopes and then we have this gravitational detection tool.
Uh-huh.
And there are actually two ways of detecting similar things.
Right.
Yes. That's different too.
This is the thing that's really cool, is that it's not like it's already a big deal to say, hey guys, here's a completely fundamentally different way of looking at the universe. That's already a big deal. The reason it's even cooler is that we're detecting something, two black holes coming together. We've detected something that we understand pretty well already, actually.
Yeah, we do.
We already kind of understand how those dynamics would work. Of course, there are a lot of details we don't know, right? But the reason that this is so exciting is that this is a validation of that method. This is like we've taken the gravitational waves that we've detected and kind of figured out what the masses of those black holes would be from that data.
Not from the gravitational, but the other inferred information, like the time it takes for them to collide,
uh-huh.
the times of rotations. All those things, we've done the math for a long time. This allows us to confirm those things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it turns out that it kind of matches up. And
it's
what that
awesome.
Means is it's very likely that our gravitational detectors are actually detecting gravitational waves, and they're actually a real thing, and they're actually being given off by these celestial events that we already kind of understand. So this kind of opens up an incredible new world of possibility for the kinds
awesome.
Of things that we can detect and the ways that we can detect them.
Yay, science.
I love science.
So you know the band OK Go?
I love OK Go.
Great,
actually,
right?
I only know one of their... I only know...
A couple of their
one
songs.
Of, yeah, because I just... They make these crazy music videos.
They make crazy music videos. The one that they came... The first one I was aware of they performed is a song to a whole bunch of treadmills. And they're just walking in the treadmills. And they just... You've seen that scene?
Yeah, and
yeah,
they
great.
End up kind of jumping over each other.
They
and
jump
doing
over each other.
Of,
they lay down. They
it's
fall.
Acrobatic.
It's fun. Really fun.
Yeah.
They do like a complicated machinery.
Mm-hmm.
Their most recent one takes place in zero G. They're in a plane. That's doing an orbital zero G pattern.
Oh, that's amazing.
And they're dancing and moving around. And it's already got 46 million people have seen it, so maybe you've already watched it. But in any case, take a look for the OK Go zero G. And if you want to get a direct link, of course, you can go to geekspeak.org.
Take a look at all of their music videos.
Yeah,
really,
you can definitely get captivated on those.
They are. I mean, they're not as cool as gravitational waves to me, but in terms of entertainment on YouTube, that's about as good as it gets, I think.
I have to agree.
Good music, too.
You know the Internet Archive, Ben?
I do.
The Internet Archive tries to collect all of Internet data.
They don't have my first website on that.
They've got mine. Totally fun.
They do?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
But they decided to start having an archive of malware. So
what?
viruses and
this
things
is like,
of that nature.
Like what could go wrong?
Yeah,
like all
yeah.
the malware put it in a plane.
But basically, people have reduced and created viruses and programs that treat you badly for a long time. In the early days, they were clever and not normally destructive. Then they became destructive and bad and creepy, and then they start blackmailing you and stealing your money.
Like in the early days, say witty things or be like, haha, you got pwned, and then that's it.
So the Internet Archive has decided to make an archive of these early kind of, I don't know, it's kind of like... teasings and tricks. Yeah, kind of that nature. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm speaking with Mr. Ben Jaffe. And if you'd like to communicate with us any time of the week, geeks@geekspeak.org, and you can find us online at KOSP Geeks. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence, is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So use our stuff any way you'd like it. Just let them know the geeks say hi. This is Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. To find out more about this episode or any episode of GeekSpeak since 2006, somewhere in there is when I put them online. Yeah, just go to geekspeak.org and find the episode.
That's 10 years.
Yeah. Today's the 7th episode of the 16th season. Our intern, I want to thank our intern Chandler, our Canadian correspondent Greg Merkley, our musician and theme song author and creator Michael Newman of Pet Star Music.
Happy end of GeekSpeak to you. We did a story a while back about how music publisher Warner Chappell is no longer allowed to collect licensing royalties when people use the Happy Birthday song because they don't own it.
In fact, it was kind of a documentary research project, and we covered this before, that freed up the thing, saying, look, you don't really have the rights to this thing. Why are you charging people?
Filmmaker Jennifer Nelson originally filed in 2013.
Wow, and it's been a long time.
I'm very happy that she won that suit.
So now you can use that song anytime you want. You can sing it in restaurants. You can do anything you want with it. It's completely in the public domain.
Yeah, and all of the other lame Happy Birthday songs that companies have been using, they're just going to go away because they're all awful.
Now when I hear something that's not the Happy Birthday song, it gets me upset.
I know. So do you know how much? $14 million will be paid.
Huh?
So Warner has to pay $14 million back to all of the people who they charged. And that's fantastic.
That is beautiful. So what you're saying is because they kind of were collecting money, but they didn't really own the rights, they're getting dinged $14 million. Where is that money going?
Well, the people who paid them in 2009 or later are going to get a full refund. And the people who paid before 2009 are going to get, only 15% of what they paid.
Still, that's pretty cool.
But at least they have to pay them back.
I hope that idea of overusing the copyright system will spread out a bit. The waves of that will move forward.
A couple million dollars a year that they've been collecting on
good money
for a long time. So, good riddance.
That's right. Hey, Ben, thanks for doing GeekSpeak with me today.
Yeah, thanks.
That was fun. See you next week and see you online.
Bye.